You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. For decades, Mike Talo has been involved in pre-hospital emergency care, focusing on remote and wilderness medicine. As director of operations and co-founder of Finns West, he's provided remote medical services from Mount Everest to Antarctica. Talo guides for several fly fishing outfitters spanning Colorado all the way to Chile. In this episode of Anchored, Talo shares how his passion for fishing, paired with his profession as a wilderness and remote paramedic, made a business unlike any other in the fly fishing industry. If you haven't already checked out anchoredoutdoors.com, it's probably time that you do. Anchored Outdoors combines education, community, and accessibility all in a sequential system that's fun and easy to follow. I know that free content is everywhere these days, but that doesn't make it accurate or trustworthy. I also know that you'd prefer to spend your time on the water instead of figuring out who and what to trust, which is why we cut straight to the chase and do it for you with step-by-step guides, renowned instructors you've come to know and love from the show, our ever-growing library, interactive events, and even our fun point system that lets you earn up to $200 in premium points. We've got all sorts of exciting new surprises around the corner, including a members-only podcast so you can listen to our classes and content while you drive. Find out more at anchoredoutdoors.com.
I was born in Western North Carolina. So in a small town called Elkin, just down from, I'd say the closest place that people would know is probably the Boone, Asheville area in the mountains.
Oh, it's beautiful over there. I love Asheville.
It's a cool place. And ironically, I'm here on the coast now.
Okay, so you never left. I mean, is that the South? Are we calling that the South?
Oh, yeah. I mean, North Carolina, it's about as south as you can get.
Proper south. Yeah. I remember years ago I did an event down there and driving through the beautiful mountains, the Appalachians. I think I used to call it Appalachian and I was corrected. And remember, I was coming off of living for a year in Arkansas, so I was pretty comfortable with the South. And I was seeing houses with Confederate flags and all sorts of new things that this Canadian girl had never seen before. Is it still very much like that? I don't want to go into a rabbit hole. I mean, I've just pressed record, but is it still very Southern, or has it come a long way over the last decade or so?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you are, right? Because a lot of folks, I mean, again, I moved away for 30 years and came back, but a lot of folks are coming to the coast and mountains of North Carolina. So there's little pockets of change, but yeah, it's the little pockets are still there. There's the house. There's several houses down the river here that are throwing the Confederate flag for sure.
It was an experience. So where did you go for 30 years?
I was in Colorado for most of that and lived in Montana for about five of those 30.
Okay. So what brought you there? And I mean, I guess I'm kind of starting in the middle and we'll backtrack to the very beginning, but just out of curiosity while we're there, why did you end up moving what I guess you guys would say out west?
Yeah, out west is good. The climbing, the paddling, the skiing. I mean, I'd done it here in North Carolina. It's a great place, but not like everybody, just bigger is better. So, and I couldn't get a foothold here, which is a whole nother story. So headed out west and stayed.
Let me back you up to where you really started fishing. Did you get started in fishing, or did you start in climbing, rafting? Where was your beginning?
Yeah, you know, our family, we did. I mean, we're from the mountains of North Carolina, so we definitely fished and hunted and did nothing huge. I mean, I don't have that typical story that I started when I was 3 years old and moved to Montana and fished my whole time. But yeah, we did. We had a place here on the coast, so it was kind of cool. Got to do salt water and learned to fly fish pretty young. But then that was it. When I got into climbing and skiing, I did not pick up a fly rod again until decades later, believe it or not. I'm one of those.
Okay, so what inspired you to get back into fly fishing?
I think I've been asked this, but I think our schedule, being a paramedic and a flight medic, we have the best schedule in the world, right? We work 24, we're off 24, work another one. Then we have like 4 days off, right? So a lot of the things that I was doing, backcountry skiing, climbing, that kind of stuff, you kind of needed a partner, right? And I just needed to find, I didn't want to be out in the backcountry, you know, skiing by myself. So I said, you know what, I lived in the South Platte Valley. So the Arkansas, the South Platte, Spinney. I just lived in this amazing place and still lived there for 10 years before I picked fly rod back up. And I just started fishing, and that was it. Like, to the point, not long after, I went part-time, helped open a fly shop, a local fly shop. It's just the typical cliche that once I started doing it, I just like, holy shit, this is great.
It's not that typical. I'm obviously frothing at the bit to get into your business here, but I need to remember that we need to start with you personally and obviously your credentials. So talk to us about high school. So you graduate high school. What are you going to do?
Yeah, so I actually went to boarding school in Virginia, and that's going to become very important in this story. It may jog a little interview you've done before. Yeah, I went to school with Carter Andrew.
Okay.
So keep that. That's going to come back into play several decades later. went to boarding school in Virginia. Didn't quite make it to graduation, so I came back home, finished high school back home. Dabbled around. I went to college for marine technology. I was going after my tonnage captain's license. So sort of the writing was on the wall way back then. Didn't make it because we lived at the beach. So if it was chest ahead, we were surfing instead of going to class. So then went to the mountains, went to several colleges in the mountains to try to get away from the coast. Ended up paddling and climbing. That didn't work out. Came back to the middle of the state, did forestry. That didn't work out because now I could go either east or west in the state and surf or climb. So I didn't have a foothold. I got an associate's, I think, in sciences. That was it. And then I headed out west. I had no clue what I was going to do.
Out of curiosity, what's the deal with boarding school? Were you sent there for behavior, or was it just that there were no decent schools in your area?
Yeah, the behavior stuff was earlier. They took care of that at another situation earlier. No, it was just a small mountain town, and my parents just thought maybe I should go to get a better education and meet different people, which I think the people that I grew up with were fine. But it was the best thing on planet Earth. Obviously, you'll see full circle why it was and who I met and how that worked out decades later.
Take me down the path. Walk me through it.
Went out west to get a foothold, figure out what I was going to do, which ended up being a ski and climbing bum in Colorado. And that was good. Didn't fish again, full disclosure. I don't think I picked up a spinning rod, conventional and or fly rod the entire time prior to moving to Montana. Came back to North Carolina because I needed to make some money, and painted propane tanks one summer, I think, for my brother, and took an EMT class. So here's a pivot. I just doing all this backcountry outdoor stuff. I had taken a wilderness first aid class and was like, holy shit, this is great. Didn't even know this existed. Was back home, bored out of my mind, still climbing and doing that, but took an EMT class, was like, wow, this this is better. If something happens in the backcountry on the river, I kind of think I know what to do. Not at a professional level, I don't even know, but I have more info. Went back out west that fall, I guess. And, you know, this is funny. I take that back. I did pick up a fly rod. We're going to segue for a minute.
I love a segue.
A bunch of us from North Carolina, we lived there were several groups of folks from North Carolina that were in Boulder, Aspen, Vail. You know how it goes. People move and spread out. We all ended up on a dude ranch in Colorado on the Rio Grande, ran right through it. It was a fly fishing ranch, but it was a working, you know, they had horses and cattle, and people from Denver came to fly fish and ride horses, that whole Western scene. I was a ranch hand. Like, I cut wood and drove a tractor. I mean, it had nothing to do with fly fishing. But come fall, the guides went back to school. So there were no guides. So they were like, dude, you fish kind of. I'm like, well, not really. So every morning I would get up and call Durango to the head guide that was back in school and go, all right, dude, what is it that I need to tie on for this dude? What's going on up here? And I would go out and I was a fly fishing guide for like a month and a half. It was great. I had no clue what I was doing, but it was great.
Love it.
I will not name the ranch because that doesn't look good on them. So anyway, we all ended up at this ranch. And when the season was over, winter was hitting, we were headed to Alaska. One of my good buddies and a couple of people were like, we're going to Alaska. We're going to ski, whatever, mountaineer climb, we're gone. We made it as far as Whitefish, Montana, and there was 900 inches of snow on the ground. And the rest is history. We laid down roots, and we were in Whitefish.
Doing what?
So, again, we were still on the whole ski, climbing, bum thing. So, worked on the mountain, doing washing dishes, maybe, cooking, whatever, just to be able to ski, to get a ski pass for Big Mountain. But then, because I was an EMT and could ski, actually snowboard at that point, I started ski patrolling, which, again, a pivotal moment, because now this medicine is starting to be, you know, part of the career, which is great. Ski patrol down in Missoula, up on Big Mountain, started working, volunteering for the search and rescue group. So it was all kind of coming together, and I dug it. I love the rescue part of it. You know, the medicine, not so much yet. And then randomly, we had gone to Driggs, Idaho. I went with a friend. I think I was dating this girl. And we went to Driggs to run a dog sled operation while the head dude was off racing. And that was amazing. I mean, I just, like Oliver says, White, 90% of this is luck. But once you have that luck, you work your ass off to make it work. So she just said, hey, I need some help tending these dogs in Driggs. So went to Driggs, did that for a month. Okay, this is pertinent, I promise. On the way back to Whitefish, a buddy called me or something. I don't know if there were cell phones. I'm old. So somehow stopped in Missoula and said, hey, there is a ambulance service in Polson, Montana, looking for EMTs full time. Okay, picture this. Carhartt bibs, dog shit in my hair. I had hair down my back. Smelled like dogs. I had my dog in the truck. I stopped in this place because I was like, there's not a chance in hell. I walked in and said, hey, well, I'm an EMT. I ski patrol. I'm fairly new. I live up the road. And I was hired on the spot. And I was a full-time EMT. Like 2 weeks later, I moved my stuff to Polson. Lived in the station. For people in the business, they'll understand that. But lived in a trailer inside the ambulance bay and ran calls nonstop for the next year. It was great. It was trial by fire.
So when you were doing ski patrol, did you have to do any sort of crazy rescues? Was it cruisy?
Yeah, I mean, again, I was Missoula and Big Mountain and Whitefish. It's not that aggro, right? I mean, there is backcountry, and yeah, I mean, there, not so much rescues. You got to remember too, I was new to this whole thing. Well, and it was the first time they had incorporated a snowboarder on ski patrol, and this was in Missoula. So I was just trying to wrap my head around that as well. So no, the rescue ski patrolling, not so much, but had an opportunity to start the flight medicine thing when I was in Montana. And our bird was the rescue helicopter for Glacier National Park. So that's where those doors, I mean, I shouldn't even, as inexperienced as I was and where I was, I should have never had this opportunity. But my partner on the ambulance was a full-time flight medic up there, and it just worked out. So I kind of got that bug of, you know, the death spiral in a helicopter, and that was awesome. So that set the seed for medicine and rescue, I think.
It was less outdoor-based accidents, obviously, and a lot more human-inflicted issues.
Well, yeah, on the ambulance, because, you know, traditional ambulance service, you run 911 calls, right? So our search and rescue up there, we did. That was the, I don't know, I didn't care about lost people, but, you know, the found people that we needed to go get and haul out of the backcountry, whether it was, you know, snowmobilers, backcountry skiers, that kind of stuff. That's what I really like. But my day job as a, you know, a EMT on an ambulance, I wasn't a paramedic yet. That was just 911 calls. Oh. Just a normal, you go in, they call 911 because they're sick, injured, or ill, and you go get them. But we were hours from the hospital. So they're through in this whole rural remote medical portion of the whole thing.
Right. So at that point, are you looking at the stark contrast between the two roles that you're playing and starting to decide that for your future, you'd rather go down one path or the other?
Well, no, I pretty much decided that flight medicine, being a flight medic on the helicopter as a paramedic, that's exactly what I wanted to do, which brought me back to Colorado. For sure. Again, I just, the light bulb hadn't gone off with the career as a rescue person, like, right. Ski patrol, great career. I wasn't good enough. Right. And that, you know, could have gone down that path, but I'd already started down the medical side. So I chose flight medicine, came back to Colorado to go back to school. Cause look, if I was going to do this with, this is going to sound so cliche, but look, these are people's lives. And if I was going to do it, being not the most studious individual, I was going to do it right. I was going to go find the best school, the best instructors, learn it, and, you know, do the best that I could. Eh?
All right. So bring me back to the timeline, because I interrupted you. You were talking about pivotal moments.
So when I decided I wanted to do flight medicine, for some reason, I believe I couldn't get into a paramedic program within a year or so, and I was ready, because if I'd have waited any longer, I would have ended up, you know, being a raft guide for the rest of my life or whatever. But so went back to Colorado, got into the actual program I wanted to get into, which was in Colorado Springs. So it was a Denver program. And if it would have been in Denver, probably wouldn't have done it, because I would have lost my friggin' mind living anywhere near Denver. No offense to Denver folks, but it was in Colorado Springs. It's where the instructors were. And this is for paramedic school. It had nothing to do with flight, but you had to be a paramedic and you had to have experience. So I had to start there, right? So I packed up everything. I think I came back home, North Carolina, to get my shit together. Went back to Colorado since I'd already kind of been there, and found a nice little mountain town, which was Woodland Park in Divide, which I lived for the next 28 years. But went to paramedic school and finished that. It was about a 2-year ordeal all in. I mean, now I think these kids can go for like 4 months. I don't understand. But finished up that. And while I was there, again, right place, right time, I got a job at another ambulance service in the mountains, and they did do rescues, right? So this small mountain town ambulance service did the backcountry rescues and all that stuff. So when I finished paramedic school, I was now full-time as a paramedic in Woodland Park with UPRAD Ambulance, and that's where it all started.
All right. So tell me what you mean by all started. Let's talk about your business. I think it's fascinating.
I had to get experience, right? I mean, period. It's just like in anything you do. I knew I had to put my head down, and this was a great place to learn. We were pretty far from the hospital, which means your medicine had to be dialed, right? It wasn't like downtown Atlanta where you throw somebody in the back of an ambulance and you're at the hospital, 1 p.m. in like 3 minutes. I mean, you were actually with patients for hours. So great start. And I just did that. And I ran a mountain rescue team during that time period out of Divide as well. So started getting that sort of background. And about 5 years, don't hold me. People are going to listen to this and say, you moron, it was 3 years or it was 10 years. I don't know. I was sitting in the front seat of a Denver General ambulance. Segue real quick. Because we were more mountain, rural medicine, wilderness, backcountry, we would go to Denver and ride with like the full trauma buses and do shifts there to keep your skills up, right? Because it was a madhouse in downtown Denver back then, right? So it had been like 5 years, I think. 6 years, 5 years, I don't remember. Since I've been a paramedic, I'm in the front seat of this ambulance. I got a bulletproof vest on under my uniform, sweating balls, sitting there going, man, I need to focus. I need to take the next step for either flight or wilderness medicine, one of the two. And the guy I was working with said, hey, dude, he was reading like a paramedic magazine, like, you know, like a fishing magazine for paramedics. And he said, here's a job in Antarctica. They need a paramedic with rescue background. I'm like, what? I mean, where's that? That's down south. This is amazing. The next morning, I called the contractor that had the contract for Antarctica. They were in Denver. Go figure. Said, what's the deal? And he said, yeah, I need a paramedic firefighter in Antarctica for this research station. And when can you go? And I said, well, tomorrow, 3 months later, I'm on a plane heading to Antarctica. It's great.
Oh, my gosh. Wait, how many people were down there? What's it like? I've got a million questions for you, and none of them are fly fishing related, but I'm going to ask them anyway. How many people live in Antarctica? Does anyone live in Antarctica? Is it the Antarctica? Is it just Antarctica? How many people are there?
It's just Antarctica. So the quick rundown, I guess, is, and I'm going to do the U.S., work with a ton of Kiwis. They were right beside of us at their research station, a ton of Australians. Anyway, so the U.S., it's all peaceful research in Antarctica. Nobody lives there. Nobody has claim of the place. There's just peaceful research, and there's a Antarctic treaty with X amount of countries that participate in research. So the U.S. has three research stations, McMurdo Station, which a bunch of people have heard of. It's been in the news off and on a bunch for random reasons. They have one at the south, literally the geographic South Pole. And then they have one over on the, I guess, the Chilean side of Antarctica. So you, and this is going to come full circle again later on if we keep chatting, but on the peninsula of Antarctica where you access it via Punta Arenas, Chile. Again, going to come full circle there. So it's just research. At McMurdo, in a busy season, non-COVID, I don't even want to go there, but it's like 1,200 people during the summer months. And it's, I can describe it as a West Virginia coal mining town with a college in the middle, right? So dorms, cafeteria style, but they're there to support science, everything from doctors, nurses, paramedics, bulldozer drivers, janitors, construction guys, all there to support like four scientists. Well, I'm kidding. But scientists on the continent.
Did you ever have to actually go out and find somebody? This is going to be really dramatic and really grotesque, but did you ever have to find someone who was missing, or did you have to deal with polar bears, or was there anything that was just absolutely extraordinary that you had to deal with down there?
No, totally. Now, there are no polar bears at the South Pole, April. They're all up north. It's funny because that is the number one question people ask for the last 35 years of my life. No polar bears. Yeah, totally. So the way it's set up down there is a field safety department, and they're mountaineers, you know, Denali, Everest. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, again, I got thrown into this just like kind of up in Montana. I rolled in, and to this day, some of the most incredible mountaineers on planet Earth back in the day were there running field safety. And they would go with the scientists out to the field, you know, for crevasse safety. They would test the sea ice. They would do what we call the cold weather school, where everybody had to do it that was going out in the field. So because I was a paramedic with that background at the fire department, I went down to work at the fire department. That did not work out because I'm not a structured, you know, be in this incredible place in Antarctica. But now I'm at this, and it was a fire department. I had fire trucks, the whole nine, but it just wasn't. But because of my background, because of just the way the contract was, I was now put on the search and rescue team in field safety with my mountaineering background and being a paramedic. So I did like all three jobs. I worked in the clinic as well, hence where I met my wife, right? So you did it all. And yeah, there were, plane. I mean, I can't, because it's a government contract, I can't be too specific, but yes, there were plane crashes, crevasse falls. There was, and we trained, oh my gosh, we had helicopters. We had the Coast Guard helicopters. It was like going to the best rescue school on planet Earth, for sure.
Got it. Wow. What an experience. So then what happens?
Again, I'm painting this picture, and again, there's people well above what I do in this world. This just happened to be my little space. We need to roll along here because this timeline's all over. But Kristen, my wife, who was not my wife at the time, same situation. She was in Seattle in the ER doing something, whatever. She is an emergency medicine PA. Backcountry skier, climber, wilderness medicine background. Same thing, was sitting there going, I need to do something adventurous. Found this job, went down and worked at the research station as the, an emergency medicine PA at the clinic. But because of their background and search and blah, 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 she was also on the search and rescue team in Antarctica. So we met, and I'm going to have to segue because it will tell you how we have our company, not FinsWest. We're not even close to that yet. The contract, this whole operation used to be run by the Navy. The VXC-6, the United States Navy, ran 90% of the support. They flew you there. They had all the medical personnel, all the heavy equipment operator. It was government contract. Navy ran it. The year we went down, it had gone civilian. So they were phasing out the military, except to fly us from Christchurch, New Zealand, to get us there. The Air Guard still flies us there. And they were still doing on-continent flights, landing on skier birds out in the field to get us to our camp. But everything else was phasing out. So there was a civilian contractor who had never in their wildest dreams had ever run an operation in Antarctica with 1,200 people and three stations and so forth. So being at the right place at the right time, I think it was the second year we were there, we were helping build the wilderness medicine program, right? So all the expeditions that go out in the field needed to take equipment and medicine and have protocols. And Chris and I, with that background, we were helping both in the summer back in the States in Denver and while we were down there. And legal or not, I'm not real sure the ethical thing, but they said, look, if y'all start a company, we will hire you to do this job. And that summer I went to the Secretary of State in downtown Denver and stood there as a 28-year-old going, yeah, lady, I need to start a company to get a government contract. No clue. And 3 months later, Katabatic Consulting was born, and we've had it for 22 years, the contract.
What did you say the consulting company was called?
So our parent company, whatever you call it, is called Katabatic Consulting and Technical Services. So, boom, we had it. We were now a government contractor. You know, we did everything right, and it was awesome. And again, 22 years later, we're there, and we still run. Ironically, we are the EMS coordinators for the fire department that I worked at, 22 years ago. We manage all the pre-hospital folks on the SAR team, the two vessels that are based out of Punta Arenas, Chile. We manage them, all the medical on both those research vessels. It's pretty cool. And it's just two of us. We're small.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Are you still active in Antarctica?
You mean physically or we still manage the Antarctic Wilderness Medicine and Field Medicine program, but we quit going to the continent probably 5 years ago. It's not in our contract that we have to go, but we did. I mean, we would go down and actually work for the program outside of our contract. It was pretty cool. So we'd go down as mountaineers, base camp managers, and obviously the medical people at these field camps. So it was kind of cool, but yeah, look, it's cold there. I'm done.
This is going to make me sound really dumb, but I have to know. I guess I could Google it, but I've got you here. What are the animals down there? So, and why are there no polar bears there?
Now, I can't answer that genetics. I don't know that why there's none down there, but there are seals, whales, penguins, birds. So that's it. That are the, and tons of like oceany critters. I mean, they do dive expeditions under the ice, which that's not my jam. No way.
The other question that is nagging at me that I just have to ask is, what is the main difference between wilderness medicine and what would you call it?
Just standard first aid, standard medicine. Great question. So here's the thing. It's pretty straightforward. Standard, typical first aid courses that you go take with, say, American Heart, the Red Cross, that kind of stuff, they're amazing. They're awesome. But they are specifically designed for quick 911 emergency service access, right? So, in other words, shit hits the fan, you know how to take care of it for the first, 4, 5, 8 minutes, but 911 has been called. And then eventually, paramedics, fire, somebody shows up to now take this situation away from you, right? Wilderness is beyond that, right? And again, the standard first aid stuff is great. And I could harp on that for a long time, right? It's awesome. Teaches people what they need to know, but it sort of stops at, okay, we know, we hope, the ambulance, somebody's going to show up within 8-10 minutes. Wilderness medicine picks up from there. So the definition of time, I would rather give examples rather than time, but wilderness medicine now says, okay, you've done the 8 minutes of stuff. There's still shit going on and nobody's coming. What do you do now, for the next 30 minutes, 4 days, 2 weeks? How do you manage this emergency, this crisis beyond 911, right?
What is the most common wilderness issue in your experience? Would it be dehydration? Would it be...
It's obviously, this gets asked, it's going to be common musculoskeletal issues. So musculoskeletal, right? Twist, sprain, strain. It is what it is. Repetitive use injuries, stuff like that. People are skiing, knee injuries, climbers fall. Now there's trauma there, but to be honest, it's really the it's the strains, sprains, and sort of breaks and fractures, really.
How do you fix something like that? And again, we could go down a crazy rabbit hole, so I'm going to be cautious, but just again, nagging curiosity. Would you just make sure that you always have a tensor bandage on you? Like, could you fix it with a piece of clothing and a stick? Is there an easy fix for a sprain? Or does that just depend on the appendage?
So I don't think we can go down that rabbit hole, because then now I'm throwing out a first aid class on Anchored Podcast. But here's what I do want to say. Here's how you fix it. You take a course, you know what you're doing, and since it's 2023, you don't need to use a stick in clothing. And this was a great segue. There are pieces of first aid and medical equipment that the common, wilderness first aider, can carry with them to like do the right thing. So people have this misconception of wilderness first aid or EMS is like using burr root to stop bleeding or using two sticks to, but it is, but it's to teach you the right way to do it. Let's say away from, with less equipment, and then you can improvise with what knowledge you now know, right? So we don't teach splinting with sticks and stuff anymore, because we teach the right way. Then you can critically think how to do it with the shit that's laying around you, which you should have some first aid stuff, right?
Where would you suggest people take their wilderness course? Because I know I looked into doing one at some point and I was getting so much feedback that it was overwhelming. Is there one course or one organization in particular that you'd recommend for fly fish or for fishermen and women specifically?
Well, always it would be Fins West, for sure. But no, we're very, and that would be a hard thing to do. This is what I would say. Unfortunately, and a little bit of history, instead of just giving a rote answer, the whole wilderness first aid genre, I guess, I can't think of the right word. It's not regulated, right? In Canada, it actually is a little bit more than down here for sure. And it's unfortunate because any Joe Bob that, went to Boy Scout training can start a company and say they're doing wilderness first aid. However, there is a standard.
I have to tell you that that's where the confusion was coming in, is I was hearing from Americans and then I had Canadians and Aussies and everybody was weighing in. And it was sounding very confusing about if you want to go through and get certified for X, Y, and Z, then this will work and that won't work. And it was so overwhelming that I just took a step back. So I would love for you to dive into this, not only for me selfishly, but for other people who have also been kind of put off by all the confusion.
Yeah, totally. There are some reputable companies out there, right, that teach the wilderness first aid. And they are accepted by a multitude of organizations, whether it's fishing, rafting, climbing, whatever. And they usually dictate, right? So the organization that you're working for usually has a list or preferred places that they will accept. I think the other way is just the good old fashioned, go look at the reviews, reach out to folks. And I hate to say this because now people are going to reach out to me nonstop, but look at there's five or six really incredible schools that stick to the standard, have a curriculum. They've been known for a while. And that's Knowles. So WMI, Wilderness Medical Institute, Desert Mountain Medicine here in the States, Wilderness Medical Associates, who we taught for years. Solo is another great one. Remote Medicine International, RMI, used to be. I hadn't kept up with those guys. And then Canada, I'm not real sure. I have talked to a couple of Canadian organizations because a few of our mountaineers that have certifications in Antarctica, we have to review them. They've gotten them up in Canada. So I've called these people up to see what their curriculum is and done some research. And look, what I've found up in Canada is, they don't mess around. I mean, there's not many hokey wilderness first aid, wilderness medicine companies up there, right?
Yeah. So talk to me about Finns West. Before I suggest that everybody bombard you with requests to take your courses, tell me how you guys ended up moving into Finns West first, and then we could talk about what it is that you guys do there.
Yep, totally. And this is probably the coolest story of this whole thing, I think. You would think that being a guide and doing the wilderness courses, because again, with our company Catabatic, we also did these wilderness first aid and medical courses, right? But just not in the fishing industry. That I would have come up with this, but I did not. Matter of fact, it took a while, even when it was beat me on the head. So randomly in Denver, can't tell you when, it's been 8 years, 10 years ago, the fly show, maybe the fly fishing rendezvous, one of the trade show fly fishing shows in Denver reached out and said, hey, you've got this company that teaches wilderness, you know, first aid, you're a guide. Can you come do a presentation on like first aid for anglers and lodges and stuff? Again, the light bulb did not go off. I just said, holy shit, I'm going to get a free pass to the fly fishing show. This is great. So I was, and I think it was because I told Treminski, I believe, I said, look, man, you understand that this is, I'm going to be talking about first aid and medical stuff at a fly fishing show. You're taking a chance. He said, doesn't matter. Let's mix it up. I think it's important. Let's try it. I'm like, all right, cool. So I just took, you know, having spoke at different medical conferences and stuff, I just took my normal decision. The cat's trying to jump up. So anyway, and just put pictures of fishing in there and just sort of dialed it in, you know, for the angler and being on the river and the raft or whatever. And I went in and listen, the place was packed. And I had to ask everybody to make sure, hey, do y'all know that this is, you know, first aid for the angler? And they're like, yeah, I guess nothing was going on. So I did the presentation, tons of questions. I couldn't believe it. I was like, holy shit, this is pretty cool. No light bulb yet. When I finished, a dude came up and introduced himself and said, hey, look, I've been guiding at this lodge in Alaska for the past 20 years. I just bought it. I'm a ski patroller here in Colorado. I get what you're doing. Can you come up and do a course for my guides and staff and do an emergency action plan for my operation? The light bulb went off. Boom. Big time.
Good.
So I'm like, holy cow, sure. I get to go to Alaska. You know, and I've been up there. We did a couple of TV, I'm not even going to, whatever. Our other company did some medical and safety standby for a couple of TV shows in Alaska. I'd fished up there before, but not like pre-season with these guys on the Alagnac. It was amazing. And, you know, obviously we're used to doing courses in the woods, right? Just, we have the stuff. So we went up and did it and it was great. It was awesome. And I worried about the guides and staff being engaged. But again, I was a guide, right? I knew what they did. I understood the environment. I understood their clients and I knew they were fucking in the middle of nowhere, Alaska. So that was it. That hadn't started yet, but that's where the idea came from. Okay, are you ready for this? Here comes some name dropping and we're coming full circle.
Coming hard, go for it.
So prior to that, Chris and I had gone to Patagonia River Ranch in Argentina. I went down to look at the lodge to do some hosted shit when I was in Colorado. But while I was there, they found out what we did. We went back there and taught a course several years before this. Light bulbs still did not go off back then, right? So I come home and I'm like, man, I wonder if this is needed. Do people give a shit? I don't know. So sitting on my desk were like 9 magazines with Big Boy Carter Andrews' face on every one of them. I'm like, you know, I've been seeing Carter on all, and we had sort of lost touch. I mean, I hadn't talked to him in a long time. I sent him an email and said, yo, randomly, this is Taylor. And we lived in the same dorm his last year. He's older than I am. I said, look, I need to talk to you. Let's chat. And we hooked up. I told him what we're doing. He said, man, I think it's great. It's needed. He said, but I'm going to introduce you to, said, do you know Oliver White? And I'm like, what, really? And Oliver and I are from the same town. I had no idea, except for the fishing stuff, who Oliver was. I mean, now with that being said, I live sort of down the valley from Oliver, but I know who he was, except, you know, seeing him blow up in the fishing industry. I'm like, yeah, no, don't know him. Oddly enough, we live in the same place, or did. So he introduces. Oliver said, dude, I'm on board 100%. Absolutely, it's needed. And we were booked at Bears and Abaco before we got off the phone. So Fins West was created right then.
So how does that look? Then lodges fly you and Chris in, and you teach their staff, or do you also help to teach the clients? Like, what's the basic protocol as far as hiring you?
Yeah, nope. So we come in, and it's for the guides and the staff for the lodge. And again, we could go down this rabbit hole as well. So for when we first started, Oliver had the ability for Abaco, I believe. I think there were two clients. So we picked a week. I mean, our course is two. Well, for going and doing a lodge, we have a one day for like walkwayed, shops that do trips that aren't that remote, but they need this training. But we won't go to the Bahamas and do a one day course. So it's either a 2 or 3 day course. So the lodge is just, and with Oliver, it was a great testing thing because he had a couple of clients. So we were like, well, we can do this. I mean, right? We're not this big company that says these courses are from 8 to 5, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and you have to be there. We just worked around it, and we did a 3-day course, and the guides that were guiding that day, they came in at night, and we set them down, and we called them up to what, we were doing. We try to get everybody to be there on day one because it's the most important. It builds on the rest of the course, right?
Between Alaska and the flats, I mean, to me, it just sounds like such a huge difference. Did you have a hard time adjusting, or is it basically the same class but just with slight variations?
That's it. So they're all custom. So there's a huge difference in the guides up on the Alagnac in Bristol Bay than on the Marls in the Bahamas. However, we've done them all. Now, that sounds very pretentious. What I mean is we understand the environment of not anywhere, but we've salt fished. I mean, we've been to lodges. Now we're 10 years in. So we didn't talk about, say, altitude illness, right, or bears at Abaco. But we also didn't talk about sea urchins and,
salt water.
Well, hypothermia we did, but you know what I mean? We customize it to the environment that there are. And because we're guides, now, Kristen is not a guide. She's just badass, right? So it doesn't matter. She shouldn't have to be a guide. But we understand the injuries that they see. We know what a polling platform is. We know. But look, medicine is medicine no matter where you are. You just have to put these people in the right situation on how to do the medicine where they are, right? Yep.
But not all of your classes or not all of your courses are on location. I'm assuming you have courses on location at home. Do you do standard classes near where you live, or is everything on location?
Yeah. So with Katabatic Mountain School, which is our wilderness first aid for Katabatic, we used to host courses. Like we would throw up and say, hey, we're doing a 3-day, 2-day, 5-day, whatever, in the Divide area. Here's where you stay. Come do it. Total pain in the ass, right? So for the fishing side, we did a few, but a fly shop would host it. So Pete's Fly Shop would say, hey, yeah, we'll deal with that. You guys just come in. How much is it per person? You know, we'll have lunch and we'll find somewhere. Well, we, you know, there's plenty of places to do it. But our model is we go to your lodge because that's where you work, right? We do an emergency action plan for your operation, and we will not do one without having feet on the ground to see the operation.
Right, right. So how many people, let's say that I want to take one of your courses, how would that work? Would I, is there a list of upcoming classes on your website? Would I have to call Oliver and say, look, I'm bringing eight people in. Can we do a course? How does it work logistically? Or is it not for the little guy? Do we have to be a lodge owner to call to book?
People are not the little people, but our model is not doing open courses for people to sign up and come from all over. We have been so busy up until COVID, right? COVID, I don't even talk about that. I mean, we literally just started ramping up last month. I mean, and then it just went crazy. But no, Abaco, Bears, you know, we just went to El Pescador at Allie's and went Los Locos. We just went to Baja to do Los Locos. So the lodge hires us to come in for their staff and their folks. I would love for somebody to do a hosted, I mean, it would be amazing. And we've talked about it, but, you know, you've hosted before. I've got enough to deal with teaching and getting equipment there than to have to deal with come fish while you're doing it. But if somebody gets it together, we would totally do it for sure.
I've got this fear of missing out going on right now. I want to know. I need to work for a lodge and get all this information. And you go internationally as well. So my buddies in Canada who own lodges can hire you technically. Is that right?
Look, we've been trying to get up to Josh's place for years, but you know, we ramped up and COVID hit. Yeah, totally. We can go. Matter of fact, I'm going to say that 80% of our lodges are not even in the United States. They are, which makes sense. I mean, we do tons, right? We did a ton in Colorado, Firehole, a bunch in Montana, but I don't know. It's just not either at the top of their priority list or they don't consider it to be remote enough, which I wholeheartedly disagree. I consider 45 minutes an ambulance is not on top of you. That is remote, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. So how does a standard wilderness course differ from one through Fins West that specifically focuses on hunters and anglers?
All right. So I'm going to start by saying that it doesn't. In the big scheme of things, medicine is medicine. Doesn't matter if you take it from our lovely partners at WMA, WMI, Solo, AST up in Canada. It doesn't matter, right? Because medicine is medicine, right? But while we are different and focus on the angling side of things and the hunting side, which, again, that's a whole nother different thing, look, this is a shameless plug, but it's the truth. We get asked this a lot. So we have three criteria that make us no better, but just different and better. One, we are all medical providers, right? There is nobody, and there's only four of us technically that have been doing this for 20 plus years of our career, right? So instead of getting a person that was an outdoor person, right, whatever, hiker, climber, whatever, that went and took a wilderness first aid instructor class to teach the course, which is fine. I mean, I'm saying that there's nothing wrong with that. And there's some providers, right? There are some doctors, nurses, paramedics, EMTs that are instructors for these other companies without a doubt. But when you get us, you're getting a medical provider. So we can answer the questions. Our experience is there for, you know, not everything, but a lot of emergencies, both illnesses and trauma. So that's one thing. The other thing is, like you said, we're guides. We've been doing it. So we can relate to the guides. We know what they mean when they say they're on the Marls or they're on the Braids in Alaska. We know what a drift boat is. We've got drift boats. We know what a flats boat is. We own flats boats. So you take a group of people that may or may not be just focused and chomping at the bit because they have to take a first aid, and you throw people in front of them that are actually talking to them, not at them, right?
Yep. Yep, that makes sense.
And then the other thing that's kind of cool is we're all certified licensed educators, right? So we have had to go through the process to teach, not this, but in Colorado is where we did it, to teach medicine to paramedics, doctors, nurses. So we've been taught how to teach. So, you know, there's a process to be able to target people who are more visual, more hands-on. We incorporate all that into the courses to try to, you know, reach everybody.
When it comes to teaching Oliver's staff in the Bahamas or the staff in Alaska, were there any notable differences or major differences in what you were teaching, or was the curriculum pretty much the same?
Yeah, so one thing to add is medicine's medicine. Doesn't matter if you're on the moon or you're at Oliver's place or you're up on the Alagnac in Alaska, right? It's just the environment that you're in. So obviously we don't focus on sea urchins and coral cuts on the bottom of your foot in Alaska. Just like in the Bahamas, we don't talk about bear attacks, right? That kind of stuff. So the medicine is sort of the same. We just dial in what environment they're in. So we teach the same medicine, but we just try to relate to where they are and what injuries or illnesses. And some are the same, of course. So, yeah.
Was there something in particular that was a big aha moment between the guides in Alaska and the guides in the Bahamas? Was there any sort of process or any sort of technique that really had everybody go, oh my gosh, how have I been guiding for 20 years and not knowing this?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much about a technique like splinting or opening an airway or something like that. I think it's the process of managing an emergency, right? When the shit hits the fan, there's a lot going on. And particular for guides, their clients, they have a boat, they're on the river, they're on a flat. They have a lot of things to manage, to include the emergency. So I think the biggest, I guess, aha or learning moment is the process on how to critically think and manage that. And it's a three-step process that we teach all of them. It's exactly the same on how to manage first the scene, then the life threats, the shit that will kill you. You can't move on until that's fixed. And then the third is sort of the more focused and detailed treatment and assessment. And I think once you teach that and practice that through our scenarios, it all kind of comes together. They can take a deep breath, focus that, you know, they have a process instead of all over the place trying to figure out what to do first. I think that's the critical aha moment for most of these folks.
So is there a blanket process that you can share, or is it always specific to a certain situation?
Yep, no, it's the same. And, you know, it's very similar to traditional pre-hospital ENT paramedic. We just put it into more simplified terms. And it was those three things I just said. The first triangle that we teach is the scene assessment, right? Is to assess the scene, make sure everybody other than the patient and the patient is safe. How many people are there? That kind of stuff. Now that becomes specific for, say, a flats guide. And examples are pretty straightforward, but it makes them think. The prop's not turning, the boat's not drifting. Anchor the boat before you do anything. That keeps everybody else safe, and then focus. In Alaska, you know, bears. Are there bears? Which they all know this. We're not teaching them this shit. It's just putting it into okay, you want me to drop the anchor on the drift boat before I go up and say, stop bleeding. Absolutely. You can't try to treat somebody with a drift boat bouncing off stuff. Common sense,
But once you repetitively do those scenarios with the scene and then treatment, it all comes together for folks.
Right. Okay. So that's the first. And then what's the second thing? So you're assessing, what's number two?
Yeah. So that's the scene assessment, right? Is safety, how many people, what's going on? The next one is life threats, right? So you've got to find life threats and fix them fast. And again, this is the shit that will kill somebody. So we break that down. There's only three body systems that'll do it. And that's respiratory, circulatory, and neurological. So again, respiratory is breathing in your airway. Circulatory is your heart pumping, right? And that's pretty easy. If not, you do CPR. And then the other one is bleeding, which is the big one, right? I mean, you've got to stop severe bleeding. And another aha moment is how to do that appropriately, right? There's so many YouTube themes and magazine articles about how to effectively stop severe bleeding. We teach the medically correct way, right? And there's a system there too, right? Try to manage it without a tourniquet if you can, with well-aimed direct pressure, and there's a process there. If that doesn't work, you're going to have to throw a tourniquet on. And then what, right? Because again, that's where that full circle, the standard first aid, put a tourniquet on, the medics are going to show up. You put a tourniquet on in a drift boat in the middle of a lag night or a jet boat, man, you've got another 45 minutes to, what do we do now? So that now carries it. And then the third is neurological, right? And that's a head injury or any kind of change for a medical problem, such as a stroke, right? Any kind of change in their personality, that kind of stuff. They need to find out what it is, if it's a life threat, such as a stroke or a head injury, how to assess that and figure out bad or not bad, right?
Is there a common injury or occurrence that you found in speaking with guide experiences? Like, is it usually drowning? I'm assuming it's not something like stingrays. Is it a heart attack? Is there, in hearing all the guide stories, is there a common occurrence?
Yeah. You know, in our spreadsheet, when we do these things, we're like, holy cow, this has happened here 20 times kind of thing. Not really. Again, I would say that environmental are big ones. So hypothermia, cold and hyperthermia, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, especially in the tropic scenario. And then say in Alaska, it may be the cold. And the reason is it's very subtle, can be corrected, right? And another big thing, and not just our courses, but in wilderness medicine in general, is the recognition that something is headed down the wrong way. Because if you catch it early, then it doesn't become a problem. Because shit in the backcountry or remote, a very small problem, and I'm going to be facetious, but it's true. A cut on the bottom of your foot, if not taken care of, could end your trip. 2 days later, it's infected. And so it's the little things that you recognize to take care of now so it doesn't become a big problem. So recognition is a big part of the course where we do talk about medical issues. They may not be able to do anything about a stroke, but they can recognize that, holy shit, this may be a stroke. Rods in, motors down, we're out. We're gone now. Instead of, oh, I wonder what this is. Should we fish some more? It's like, yeah, no. We call it the red button. And it's become quite a tagline at the lodges. Like, we're going to make shirts. When stuff like that happens, we say, hit the red button. You can't do much. You've recognized it. Hit the red button. You're out.
I like it. What about packing? Obviously, it's actually always surprised me how all my buddies who hunt tend to pack not necessarily full first aid kits, but they always have in the back of their mind that something could happen. My buddies who ski and snowboard, same thing. But my buddies who fish, they're packing 8 weights and floating lines. I notice that they seem to leave a lot of their precautionary stuff out of their packing. Is there something or a few things that you would recommend all of us bring on a trip?
So, April, that's a loaded question because I do give a list of what to bring, right? Because there are some basic first aid items, especially the stuff that could stop severe bleeding, that could manage an airway, that needs to be in every kit. But what I find is when we give people a list, and here I go, here comes the soapbox portion of the podcast. If you give somebody a list, they go out and buy, or they buy a kit with that stuff in it, and then they put it in their pack. And the question that always is, do you even know how to use it? So I will tell you one item that everybody needs to carry, period, and then I'll talk about something else. That is a tourniquet, and you've got to know how to use it, period, right? It could save a life in a heartbeat. They're easy. They're cheap. You just got to know how to use it. And then this is what I say about what to pack and what to take. Your first aid kit is only as good as your knowledge and how to use the thing. So you take a course and you put what you've learned to treat and take care of in your first aid kit. That's better than any list that I can give, right?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
I mean, yeah, and again, we get asked this a lot. And granted, we get paid to tell people what to build in their kit. But for general discussion, you know, there's lists. You can go online and look at a list. Most of the locations that you go to, except for, you know, random stuff for the tropics or random stuff for, say, Alaska or the Rockies in Canada, are going to change. Everything else sort of remains the same. The biggest, I think, take home for a kit is that, A, you know how to use it first. And if you know, if you've taken a course and you have some basic first aid, you're going to know what to put in your kit. The next thing is, like, I'm trying to think how to word this in appropriately. There's not one first aid kit that is appropriate for every trip or river or expedition that you take. I'm not saying you have to have 15 kits, but I mean, common sense will tell you that the little sort of micro kit that you're going to use on your local river, because you do know that within a certain amount of time, an ambulance could show up or you can get somebody to the car and so forth, is not the same kit you're going to take to the Seychelles or to remote Alaska. So that's kind of the big thing, is to know that there's not one kit that's good for everything, right?
Well, look, I think that's sound advice. It's obviously not what many of us want to hear. We want to hear that if we go to the shop down the road, we can buy a $10.99 kit and throw it in our bag and be experts. But it's, I like that it's, that you're realistic. So what about learning a lot of these skills online? Do we just hop onto YouTube and Google how to use a tourniquet? Do you do any Zoom or online courses?
No. Again, I am, and I'll have to bring up COVID, and I hate it to say that I do, because, you know, it was bad and we're trying to put it behind us. That was the only time that we've considered doing some type of medical or first aid online, because you couldn't get it. You couldn't go in person. There were guys at lodges that needed it. They were going to expire. And here's the thing. I don't believe in online initial first aid training at all. You have got to put your hands on it. You've got to do scenarios. You've got to smell it, scratch it, see it. Because what it's doing is it's a mental snapshot in your head, right? So when something happens, you may have just done it in a scenario using, say, moolahs. It wasn't the real thing, but you've gone through it. When the real thing happens, you're not grasping at straws. There is something in your head that you've touched it, done it, been taught. I think that if you get a new piece of equipment, you've been taught how to use things, and you're like, ooh, I'm not sure about this tourniquet. I've not ever used it. You go look and see how to use that particular one. They're not that far apart from one another. But I think going on YouTube and trying to learn first aid, and this is a good segue, it's like going on YouTube at the river with a brand new fly rod, real line and fly, and expecting to catch a big fish on your second cast. I don't expect anybody to do appropriate first aid after cruising YouTube on a Saturday night.
Yeah, that's fair. That's absolutely fair. So how can lodges reach out to you and Chris to hire you? Just by going through the website? And this is your chance to do your shameless plug, by the way, so go for it.
Right on. It's not a shameless plug. It's pretty straightforward. We are at finswest.com, FINNSWEST. And there we are. Give us a holler. Shoot us an email. Yeah. And again, I think for the shameless plug, and I appreciate the questions that you've asked. I love this to get the information, you know, about safety and stuff and first aid. But the other difference about Fins West is we do work with lodges. I can't think of a time we've come into a lodge and done a class from 8 to 5 for 3 straight days. All the guides are there. And then, you know, at 5, we're eating dinner and we're done. We get it. We understand how lodges work. We know that they're, you know, they may have clients. There's things that need to happen. And that's what we do. We come in and blast the first day. There may be guides out the second day. We'll pick up the third day. That's the one difference is we do work with lodges because it's hard. I mean, there's some lodges that cannot get us there, especially now, because they're rolling 7 days a week, damn, 9 months out of the year. So,
yeah, I was wondering that. You know, I really wanted to learn more about you and just get a general idea on what Fins West does, but we're going to start to wrap it up. There are going to be 10 million questions thrown your way, I have no doubt. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to address that you think might come up later, or just anything you wanted to add in general?
You know, yeah, an ending thought for folks that have heard this thing is, one is, you don't have to take a wilderness first aid course. Take anything. Just take something that's appropriate that teaches you some basic first aid so you're just not out there, you know, throwing darts in the wind, right? I mean, a regular standard first aid class is a great start if you're not going to take, you know, something more appropriate for your environment, right? Have a plan no matter what you're doing. And I'm talking about on the medical side. It doesn't have to be like we do, like a 10-page emergency action plan. Just wherever you are, you're taking a trip, you're on the river, you're on a flats boat, have some plan. When something goes down, know where your kid is, where you're going to go, and how you're going to handle a situation so it doesn't just take you by surprise, right? For sure. Now, as far as first aid kits, I want to wrap up with this without a doubt. You got to know how to use what's in your kit, or you might as well carry a Ziploc bag with Band-Aids in it, right? So have an appropriate kit, know how to use it for sure. You're going to get what you pay for. So if you buy a $12 first aid kit, you're going to end up with a $12 first aid kit. Spend some money and get a good kit, right? Not every kit is perfect off the shelf. Even ours, right? Even our Conterra kits that we designed specifically for this situation, you still have to personalize it. You still have to look at it, see where you are, see where you're going, and personalize the thing, right? Not every kit is right for every situation. We chatted about that for sure. And then don't forget about what your supplies are carried in. I think that's one of the most important things. You get a cheap kit, you're going to get a cheap bag, right? So get a bomber kit construction-wise, right? Does that make sense? So good zippers, good stitching, a good quality bag, because you're going to take this thing everywhere. And if it blows up during an emergency, man, you're 6 steps behind in this situation already, for sure. Organize it too. So when the shit does hit the fan, you're not digging into a dry bag trying to find something that may save a life. When you open it, everything should be right in front of you. Quick grab, get the right stuff. And then my final thing is just don't be stupid, right?
Sound advice, easier said than done. As far as bags go, is there one in particular that you recommend? What about like a camera bag?
Well, I mean, of course, our Conterra kits are great. Take a look at them, right? Again, you're going to have to dial it in personally, but the Conterra makes the best bag. I'm not talking about stuff in it, but the best bag on the market. We've been making EMS bags for professional flight, ground, fire for 40 years. So that's a good start for sure. But there's some great kits out there. There are some actually these days, some good kits, but you just got to know what it is you're looking for, right? Take a course, know what you need and really look at what comes in a kit.
Well, I will link everything up here. Before we wrap it up, is there anything you would like to add or to ask me?
I think we're good. Thanks. Thank you, April, for doing this. Again, it's often overlooked, and we know that because we do it for a living in the fishing industry. So I appreciate you letting me babble for, it seems like, the last 19 hours talking about first aid, not myself, but just some things for people to think about. I certainly do appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. So thank you so much. Don't hang up.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in over the next few weeks as I sit down with George Daniels, Ann Miller, and more.